Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
According to USDA data for last year, hog prices averaged over $71 a hundredweight. This year, that price is more likely to average only around $59. However,
we do expect that to increase next year.
This, even though pork production's not likely to be much different than this year. So what is motivating USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jekanowski into projecting a price rise next year?
Several factors, including continued strength in demand, as well as, you know, tighter supplies of beef that should also support pork demand and ultimately hog prices.
Which he says could average $64.75 a hundredweight next year. No, it's not up to last year's $71, but it's a lot better than this year's $59. Gary Crawford, Washington.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The biggest challenge in agriculture today, from my perspective, and you all may have a different attitude about what the biggest issue is, but here's what I think it is.
Speaking late last month at Farm Progress Show, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
We had a record year in farm income last year. We had a record year the year before, the best 2 years of farm income in the history of the United States. The problem is that there has been a concentration of that farm income. If you take a look at the farms that basically generate $500,000 or more in sales, that represents 150,000 farms in America out of 2.1 million. That's 7.5% of our farming population in the country. Those farms received 89% of the farm income. Now, I was a good math, but I was good enough to know that that means that nearly 2 million farmers in the country today shared the other 11%. I had lunch with Secretary Perdue just last week, and we talked about this, and he was up in Wisconsin in 2019, and somebody asked him about this situation, and he was painfully honest with all of us. He said, well, the reality is, in essence, he said, you either have to get big or you have to get out. And I think the critical question for all of us is whether we're satisfied with that. Are we satisfied with that? I don't think we are, and I don't think we should be. And I said to him, I said, well, you know, we're doing a I showed him what I'm going to show you. He said, well, you know, I could never quite figure out how to get a different model. Well, here's the different model. You take a farm family, and you're going to ask that farm family, first of all, to talk about climate-smart agriculture. Now, what is climate-smart agriculture? There are 141 projects. We're putting $3 billion into those projects. Across every major commodity, every state in the country is participating. Farmers are going to get paid to adopt climate-smart agricultural practices with these partnerships, and their new markets are going to be created. And if you think about the system today, you can be an organic producer, high value, or you can be a commodity producer, relatively low value. There's nothing in between. Climate-smart agriculture gives you an opportunity for a value-added proposition that can increase farm income. So 141 projects increase farm income. It also, we're spending $300 million from the Inflation Reduction Act to measure, monitor, verify, and report the results of climate-smart agriculture. What that means is it gives farmers the ability to go to ecosystem service markets. These are markets like carbon markets, water markets, biodiversity markets, where people and industries will pay farmers for the sequestration of carbon and for the reduction of greenhouse gases. If you think about sequestration of carbon, there's essentially only two or three ways to do that. You got to grow trees, you got to have soil, or you got to have an ocean. There are significant resources here to increase farm income. I mentioned REAP. That's another opportunity. There's $2 billion that's going to be invested in REAP projects across the country. There's $9.7 billion that's going to be made available to rural electric cooperatives as they transition from fossil fuel-based generation to more renewable generation. They're going to need farmers to provide that renewable energy source. And the beauty of that is it means additional resources for farmers.
Speaking late last month at the Farm Progress Show, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
May 22, we thought the budget deficit for this year would be about mid-800s, $860, $870 billion, and now we're heading to 2.2. What happened?
Arizona Representative David Schweikert on why the debates on budgets right now are so vital.
Medicare costs went up dramatically. Tax receipts have fallen. So you heard about how wonderful this economy is. Isn't it neat? We're doing all these subsidized projects. Government is handing out money to anyone who wants to build a factory. Yay, socialized, nationalized economy. We functionally soft nationalized the chip industry. Isn't it wonderful? Think of what's going on. And yet tax revenues have fallen actually fairly dramatically. Brilliant economics once again from what the left did last year. And then the third thing no one seems to want to fixate on, that Inflation Reduction Act that they passed, you know, that they were celebrating here. If you even read the left-wing economists in their journals, okay, about half of inflation was supply chain stress, and yes, half of it was the excess of spending. Okay, so the people in my community, unless you've had a 20% pay hike, if you live in the Phoenix Scottsdale area, you are poorer today. You are poorer today than you were 24 months ago. And this is the insanity. And the wheels are coming off, and no one else seems willing to come behind these microphones and tell the truth. What's happening? Every dime we vote on. Because remember, Social Security, veterans benefits, those things are on autopilot. They're mandatory. They're earned benefits. They're a formula. No one here votes on them. It's borrowed money. So the old days when you heard Republicans come behind the microphone saying, well, if we would just get rid of waste and fraud, if we would just get rid of foreign aid, we'll be fine. Foreign aid is about 12 days of borrowing. And I'm going to show you a number of things where the Democrats, the left, makes crap up. The dollar amounts, well, if we would just tax rich people more, if we would just get rid of the threshold on Social Security, I'm going to show you that it's nowhere near the types of monies they misrepresent to you. We won't use the word lie tonight. I'm going to try to do my best. All right. So we're just going to run through a number of these because I gave away a little time and I only have a half an hour tonight. Actually, I probably only have 20 minutes left. Trying to actually start to demonstrate how fragile we are. There was a bond auction about 4 hours ago, 5 hours ago, of 30-year paper here, and it all sold at the very top of the market. Basically meaning if you thought interest rates were going down tomorrow, they're not. And you're starting to see actually how fragile we are. We're starting to look at numbers within 10 years. Our interest rate calculations on what we're going to pay on the debt are absolutely wrong. They're absolutely wrong. We're now starting to see math saying we may be missing in 9 budget years from now, total interest was predicted to be as high as $1.4 trillion, just the interest. I need you now to add another $315 billion on it, and that difference is just the marginal interest rate increases we've had over the last several weeks. When you're borrowing $26 trillion from the public, when you hear the $32, $33 trillion, a bunch of that is money actually we borrow from the trust funds, which are also running out of money. So why this is important? This big red hump here, that's defense spending for 2024. It's like $820, $30 billion. This one here is interest, just interest we're going to pay in 2024. My math is there's very high likelihood interest this government pays in next fiscal year will be equal to every dime we spend in defense. Interest will equal the defense budget. So next time you're talking to a leftist who says, if you would just cut defense spending, interest now is equaling defense, and that's next year. That's the budget we're working on right now.
This sets the stage for the Farm Bill debate. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think what we're, you know, the balance we're trying to strike right now, though, is that if you just did an extension of this bill to give growers certainty in 2024, the argument is that it's out of date.
Dr. Bart Fisher is former chief economist with the House Ag Committee, now co-director of the Ag and Food Policy Center.
You know, that it hasn't kept up with the cost of doing business. And so things like reference prices are low enough that it's not going to trigger support. And that, you know, the time and effort would be better spent on actually making improvements and getting a good farm bill in place as opposed to just trying to scramble to get something done for 2024. And so, you know, the real, you know, in terms of prepping for next year, that is certainly a consequence, you know, lack of information going into the growing season is certainly a consequence of not getting a farm bill done for the end of the year. But with that said, you know, you know, for in farm policy, the thing we focus on is, you know, is permanent loss. So farm bills, you know, they're rooted in the 1938 and the 1949 Act, and every farm bill since then really is just a temporary bill. And if it expires, you revert to those old bills. And so when you hear things about the dairy cliff, you know, or the sky's falling, it's because we revert to permanent law. Where, you know, if you revert to a permanent, you know, loan, for example, you know, dairy, you've got daily harvest. So it's why you hear about dairy, you know, the most, you know, starting in January 1. You know, following that, it would be wheat growers, you know, that are harvesting in late spring, early summer. You know, they would have a marketing loan under, or an old support loan under wheat at parity prices. And so, you know, I don't think we're going to have to worry about that, because I think Congress would put an extension in place before we get to that point. You know, my point is that, you know, that doesn't become an acute issue until next year, right? And so they've got a pretty good runway to be able to get it done.
And then there's conservation.
I think there's two things there for, you know, for listeners to kind of focus in on. One, you know, and one thing that's very unique about this farm bill is that, you know, a lot of it's already been reauthorized. I don't know if folks realize that. Either that or it's permanent. So, for example, crop insurance, it's permanent law, you know, in the Federal Crop Insurance Act of 1980. You know, you don't need to reauthorize a farm bill to reauthorize crop insurance. SNAP, in some respects, the old food stamp program is very similar. If you don't have another farm bill, the appropriators can keep funding it. And so most of what catches attention in the farm bill then is reauthorizing farm policy, reauthorizing conservation, except in that bill, the president's signature bill from last fall, the inflation, you know, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act that put in additional money, you know, a heavy emphasis on climate change. When they did that, they also reauthorized most of the conservation programs as well. And so you're looking at a farm bill debate right now where certainly there are other things beyond Title I of the farm bill, but that's, you know, the elephant in the room is Title I. It's the major title, or the title with major mandatory spending, that has not been reauthorized. And so that's one element on conservation, is that I don't know for sure what all will be done to conservation because it was already reauthorized in the IRA. The second thing I would highlight is that the IRA had a significant infusion. You know, depending on whose numbers you use, $15 to $20 billion was infused into Title I of the Farm Bill, but it was all earmarked for the most part for climate and for greenhouse gas mitigation. And so there is a debate raging right now over, well, do you pull that money inside of a farm bill and reprioritize where that money goes? And you saw that playing out in the press even today, just on the Senate side, because there are some who say, you know, don't touch that money. It was already decided last fall. Others who say, well, it's a new day. We're now talking about a farm bill, and, you know, we think there are better ways to spend that money. So some have even said take it entirely outside of Title II of the Farm Bill, the conservation title, and use it to make improvements to Title I, to the farm safety net. And so I think we'll have to see how all that debate plays out. But those are kind of the two major contours of the conservation debate right now.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So instead of just having one way for producers to make money, small and mid-sized producers can be a climate-smart agriculture purchaser and get a value-added opportunity.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack speaking late last month at the Farm Progress Show.
They can essentially create opportunities for being able to show the case how much carbon they're sequestering in their land through these practices and get a benefit from an ecosystem service market. They can invest in a Renewable Energy for America program and work with their local co-op and sell the excess energy. They can get a better price from their local processor. They can negotiate their own price on a local regional food system. They can take advantage of procurement. They can lower their costs with fertilizer. And they can take their agricultural waste and product and produce a multitude of products, not just sustainable aviation fuel, a wide variety of plastics, materials, fabrics, fibers, fuel, energy. It's a bio-based world. It has never been a better time to be in agriculture. So instead of just one way, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 ways to make money and one additional way to save money. And that's basically the future. So we don't have necessarily one option. Production agriculture is incredibly important. We need to continue to support it. But we have to make sure we also support small and mid-sized. And I'll finish with this. This is why it's important. It's not just important to agriculture. It's important to small communities. And the reality is simply this. If you have fewer farmers, you got fewer farm families. If you have fewer farm families, you got fewer kids in schools. You got fewer kids in schools, what happens? The schools consolidate. You got consolidated schools, you got fewer customers for those small town businesses, and they board up. You have fewer customers in those small town businesses, you got fewer people going to the hospital, you can't support the hospital, you got a clinic, not a hospital. And you've got a situation and circumstance where moms and dads and grandparents are sitting around that coffee table and basically listening to their sons and daughters and grandkids explaining why they're moving to Chicago, or why they're moving to Des Moines, or why they're moving to the Twin Cities, because they don't think there's opportunity. I think there's a different conversation can take place. I think there's a conversation where, geez, mom, dad, granddad, let's get a climate smart agriculture opportunity. Let's take advantage of those ecosystem service markets. Let's figure out how to work together with our friends down the road and produce more electricity that's produced right here in the U.S. Let's make sure we take advantage of new processing opportunities, negotiate a contract with local school. Let's make sure that we also convert our waste product into something more valuable and create rural jobs. Now, all of a sudden, kids are staying in that school, and it's expanding. Those shops aren't boarded up. They got customers. That hospital can stay open, so you don't have to travel hundreds of miles to get health care. And now, all of a sudden, you also have a population in rural communities, and this is the most important thing I'm going to say, that supports this country in this way. 15% of America's population lives in rural America. Nearly 30% of the military comes from rural America. If you have fewer kids, you're going to have fewer people available for the military. So this isn't just about agriculture. This is about the fate of small towns in rural America. So I hope that you see that we need to create a better option. Farm Bill is one tool, but it's not the only tool, and we want to remember that. There's the Commodity Credit Corporation. There's the actual budget. There are a multitude of ways in which you can support this in addition to the Farm Bill. And it's important and necessary for us to keep all of those tools available and flexible.
Speaking last month at the 70th Farm Progress Show, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Something's gone horribly, horribly wrong out there.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert, who's been sounding the alarm on debt. It sets the stage for the Farm Bill debate.
And instead of our brothers and sisters on the left and those of us on the right coming together and saying, we have a moral obligation not to have baby boomers on the street as part of their retirement, not to double senior poverty, to my young kids. Yes, I'm an old dad. I have a 14-month-old and an 8-year-old. Do they deserve to have a future? Because CBO math basically says in 20 years, if we wanted to maintain baseline services as they are today, we have to double taxes. That means my kids live in a world where they're dramatically poorer than how all of the rest of us have lived. And you want to know why the middle class is so cranky? Once again, back to something I said in the beginning. The middle class in this country is poorer today than they were 24 months ago. If you live in my community, if you haven't had over a 20% pay hike in the last 24 months, you are poorer today than you were before. This is the morality. So let's have the most difficult discussion this place is capable of. What are we going to do? I've come behind this microphone dozens and dozens and dozens of times showing you that if we could actually have a revolution in the cost of healthcare. And I've brought the ways to do it. I've brought whole sorts of charts to say, hey, did you realize diabetes is 33% of all healthcare spending? Could we have a revolution there? Are we really going to do the same old Farm Bill? Are we going to actually understand we have ways to help our brothers and sisters live healthier lives, come back into the labor force, have some economic growth, and stop watching America die? Next decade, we will have more Americans dying than being born in this country. We're dying as a society, and we're financing it ourselves. The immorality of what we're doing, whether it be the debt or the way we're hiding from it, there is hope. There is a way it works. There is a way it works. Is this place capable of actually thinking? Are we going to continue to do this, the petty, well, so-and-so hurt my feelings, so I'm going to oppose this. I'm going to like this. I'm not going to read this. Oh, this is uncomfortable. I can't go home and explain this to my Chamber of Commerce. Screw you. This is a moment of action. So I'm going to give you an absolutely radical proposal that I just want you to ruminate. I accept has no chance of passing. And I'll use this year's numbers. In the 2023 budget year, non-defense discretionary spending is, let's call it about $740 billion. About $326 billion of that is money that we're borrowing and sending to states, counties, cities. Many of them are programs I absolutely love, justice grants, other things. I have always supported these, but we're borrowing money to send to entities that have their own taxing and borrowing authority. That's the definition of insanity. For those who come in here and say, I want to defend the 10th Amendment, got a great way for you to do it. Stop borrowing money over here to send to states, and so they have to come and lobby and grovel at your office every 6 weeks. It would be hard. The hallways up and down might be depopulated because they won't be lined up at our door begging for more cash. But is it rational for us to borrow hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars over here and hand it to entities that have their own taxing authority? And to my brothers and sisters on the left, this is the punchline. You bang on me saying, well, we just need to raise taxes. Great. You control most of these cities. Go raise the taxes and make it so we stop borrowing the money.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We did see numbers that went down somewhat, and I don't know that we're finished yet in terms of reduction in acres.
Reacting to the most recent USDA crop production numbers, Mark Brown, Director of Field Services with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers.
As we look at production and see where they have us pegged, they've got the U.S. pegged at 13.1 million bales and the Texas crop at about 4.2 million bales. And, USDA for the last several years has gotten away from doing the district estimates. And so we just have the official number for the state of Texas. Tony, we are thinking in the Plains Cotton Growers service area, which is those top 42 counties on the Texas High Plains, that we're going to come somewhere in the range of about 50% of that Texas production of a total of 4.2 million. So somewhere in the range of, it could be 2.1 to 2.5 million bales. We just don't know at this point. And so we'll just have to see as we continue to wait and see how many of these fields end up going to harvest after all of the recent weather situation. You know, one other thing I wanted to talk about is the way that these numbers have impacted the market. And, Tony, I've had a lot of producers and people at the gin offices that have talked about the fact that we're seeing these reduced numbers in production in several states and in several countries across the world. And so even though we're seeing a reduction in production, we're not seeing a big change in price. And I wanted to allude to a couple of things that I keep hearing in market comments from our economists and all of our experts at the universities and other locations. But, when we look at the market, it just seems comfortable moving in that 84 to 89 cent price range. And a couple of things that I think are having an impact on that. One is the crop in Brazil. And we know that Brazil over the last few years has really come on strong as a competitor and now is running neck and neck with the United States in terms of total production. And so now and in the future, Brazil is going to be a big competitor. And the other factor is that it's just hard to get a bull market whenever you've got a suppression of the demand. And that's what we're seeing right now, not just in the United States, but I think across the globe, where we're seeing situations with inflation rates in all these different countries and seeing increased interest rates through the central banks. And so I think these things have an impact certainly on demand of textiles, especially on the apparel market. And so we just got to continue to let some of these things play out and hopefully build a stronger demand. I did see something just recently that overall there is an increasing trend for more demand for cotton being a natural and a sustainable product. So I'm going to hold hope in that for the future and hope that we continue to see good prices in the future.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
What I know about electric cars, if the battery wears out, you pull to the side of the road, you get on your cell phone, you get a charge, off you go. But if you're in an airplane and the battery wears out and you're over a lake or an ocean, what do you do?
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on sustainable aviation fuel.
The reality is we're not going to have electric planes. We're not going to have electric airplanes flying across the Atlantic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean. We're going to have low-carbon fueled airplanes. This is a 36-billion-gallon industry, and we're working hard to make sure that as massive tax credits are available to the producers of this new fuel, that those tax credits are available to soy diesel, to corn-based ethanol, to a wide range of feedstocks, so that it's not just Chinese cooking oil that can be converted into this fuel.